Good evening. Welcome to the 12th of February 2024 Council Information Session. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners, the Alexandrina Council and its communities, acknowledge the Ngandjeri, Paramount and Kaurna people as the traditional custodians of the lands and waters of our council district. I've got an apology from Councillor Maidman, and Councillor Miller is running about 10 minutes late. Oh, she's caught up time. And Councillor Livingstone is just taking her chair as well. Got a couple of external presentations first. We're starting off with Tim from Tonkins, who's going to present on the flood mitigation assessment report. I like the members should have a report in front of you to go through. Tim hasn't prepared a presentation because what I suggested is we actually step through the report and turn to the pages to go through that. I welcome Tim and we'll take some questions. As you're going through, Tim, or at the end? What's your preference?
I was thinking I could do go through the modelling assessment before we get to the mitigation options, maybe leave it open to questions then, and maybe at the end, like, go through the options. Could be a way forward.
Let's do that. Thank you, Tim.
So I can manage the screen page through this.
I think if you got a scroll button on that one.
Up, down, buttons. Oh, it is the button there. Okay. All right, so...
I'll just get you to step in front of the microphone
sorry.
If you
yep,
can.
Sorry.
You've got a screen just...
Oh, there as well. Okay. Beautiful. Yep. Okay. So I'm just checking the control, so that goes up and down. All right. So obviously there was a large flood event in November 2022 in Middleton that caused... Flooding of the township and was sort of the driver and instigator for this investigation. And the report that we were engaged to do was to investigate that event, undertake some modelling some flood modelling to sort of produce some flood maps and identify some potential flood mitigation options that could reduce the risk of flooding should a similar event occur in the future. So that's a bit of the background. I don't know if it's showing fully there, but there's quite a significant catchment that's outlined in blue in the report there. Let me go back to there. So that the blue catchment, quite a significant catchment, pretty much predominantly rural in nature, and it all is fairly well defined water course that comes obviously through the centre of Middleton and out to the coast. So the work that we did was that we built a detailed model of that catchment. We've calibrated it as best we could to, obviously there's no gauge data in Middleton, but we've tried to use best we could based on that event and the rainfall that was recorded in and around the area on that in November. And then we produced a whole lot of flood mitigation options that we analysed. So the model has a whole series of inputs, the flood modelling data. We engaged some surveyors to pick up detailed creek survey through the township of Middleton of the culverts that go under the main road and of the railway embankment and area through the caravan park. And outside of that area, there's very detailed aerial LIDAR survey that was used to find the geometry of the natural lie of the land. We had quite high quality LIDAR information given that it's quite close to the coast, so that's publicly available data that we were able to access. So that's sort of just the showing of the LIDAR, which shows the red, obviously the top end of the catchment, colour-coded down to the blue being the lower-lying areas of the catchment, and the purple there is obviously that catchment boundary that we saw earlier. We obviously did a site visit as well. We looked over the site, took a whole lot of photos, inspections, looked at the amount of, the one important part of the... of a model is to understand the, sort of the cross sections of the creek and how much big gum trees or vegetation is growing in there, to understand, to put as an input into the model so we accurately capture the type of the system that it is. And also looking at just the type of the land use upstream of the catchment. During the November event, there was acknowledged that that central column there, you see those two culverts, had some debris washed up against it. So we undertook, based on the current best practice, some culvert blockage estimates ensured that that was incorporated into the model. That's just the photo there of the November 22 event, where there was some partial blockage of that central column in the culvert. There's some detail there of the methodology of how we worked out what we think is a reasonable blockage factor to be applied to that structure. Then we needed rainfall data for the model, so that's publicly available in the Bureau of Meteorology. We got a nearby, representative of the local area to get the likely estimated intensities of rainfall events, ranging all the way from quite short duration to large duration events, and also ranging from quite frequent events that might occur, once every year or two, to something that's quite extreme, out to, 100-year event and above. On top of that, another important part of the model is rainfall patterns. So you can have no two rainfall events are the same. And the way that the Australian Standard does it now, that you typically model 10 different types of rainfall patterns, and it chooses the median event of that range. And also we looked at rainfall losses. So obviously, we'll go into it a bit later, but catchment, when you get rainfall off of typically a rural area, you don't necessarily get contribution the minute it starts raining. Often it needs to start soaking into the ground, and during the rainfall event as well, you'll get water soaking into the ground during the event. But we obviously need to get that right as part of the modelling, to get those losses into the model. So the model we're using is a RORB model. We developed a catchment system based on that, breaking up the catchment into a whole lot of sub-catchments, incorporated the initial loss, continuing loss, and there's also a thing called a KC value, and we calibrated that against some other... as I mentioned earlier, there's no specific gauge on Middleton Creek, we call it, so we had to use some other methods to calibrate that value to sort of give it some to see that we'd made sure the parameters were producing flows that we feel was close to realistic to obviously, but with hydrology it's no black and white, it's as best as the information that we've got available. So there's a picture of the RORB model, broken up into a whole series of subcatchments. And then the flow basically gets routed through the catchment, and then it produced a hydrograph or a flow rate at the bottom end of that red downstream boundary, which was then applied as the upstream boundary to our detailed flood model, which we'll see some results for in a moment. The RORB results, as I said, mentioned, were compared against some other flow estimates. And it was shown to produce reasonably reliable results, and also was able to, when those flow rates were put through the flood model, they sort of were able to accurately represent the recorded flood event that occurred during that November event. We've got the different comparison of the different flow rates, and then we've got the flow hydrographs that we then applied to the model. The main focus really was the 100-year or 1% annual exceedance probability flood event. That's generally speaking the flood event that is typically adopted as being the sort of recommended level of protection that buildings and what have you and property should be provided for in flood for flood management. But there are many, many, many parts of built-up areas that don't have that standard, but that if there was a new house to get built next to a creek, they'd typically say, we'd like you to be protected from flooding in a 1% or 100-year flood event. But we did need to look at those smaller events as well, because we wanted to look at what was the standard of the system currently, going all the way through to a 100-year event. So just a few little plots here, but this is sort of the hydrograph for different events, and you can see the obviously the larger the event, the higher the peak in the hydrograph, going up to I think 30 cumex or 30,000 litres per second in the 100-year event, and obviously smaller events were not as severe. So as part of our engagement as well, we sort of wanted to look at, well, what was that November 22 flood event? Was it sort of off the charts, or was it something you're going to see every few years? And so we analysed a whole lot of data. We got the live radar imagery, which shows, that shows a snapshot that it obviously was a wide band of rain that came all the way through the Mount Lofty Ranges. And the obviously there wasn't there's anecdotal information of local rain gauges, but the main specific rain gauge that we had wasn't obviously right in the area, so we had to infer that information from that and sort of interpolate between existing systems. But there was only one actual sub-daily rainfall gauge. So obviously the records to 24 hours aren't much good when you want to actually find out how much rain fell within, like, say, a 2 or 3 hour period. And that's where we had to go. We looked at the nearest sub-daily gauge was at Strathalbyn, obviously not all that close, but it's the closest one we had. And we had daily records, I think, in Galwa and Victor Harbour as well. And again, it's not a black and white 100% accurate assessment, but our interpretation of the data, the extent of flooding that we got when we were trying to put flow rates through our flood model and what have you, is that we felt that event was close to a 100-year event or a 1% annual exceedance probability. And I think I'd like to clarify that a 100-year event doesn't mean that it means it's not a 1-in-100-year event and therefore it won't happen for another 100 years. You can get 100-year events 2 months apart from each other, or you can have none of them occur for 500 years. It just means in any 1 year there is a 1% chance that you may get an event of that magnitude. So that was just the analysis of that November 2022 event. We think it was certainly more than what the rainfall data would tell us at Strathalbyn, looking at all the information, and it was certainly localised, quite heavy rainfall in the contributing catchment. The other thing also to note from that November 22 event is we looked at the data from sort of August, September and October leading up to that November 22 event, and some of the rainfall monthly records were in the highest sort of 10 percentile of those months. So if we had that same event in, say, an end of a dry summer in March, or say about now, it may not have produced anywhere near as significant a flow event through Middleton, because all the farm dams would have been a lot emptier, the catchment would have been a lot drier, it would have absorbed a lot more of that initial rainfall. Whereas certainly leading up to November 22, we're pretty confident that a lot of the dams were quite full based on the heavy rainfall that had been occurring August, September and October before the event. So a 100-year rainfall event doesn't necessarily produce a 100-year flood. You can get a 50-year rainfall event or a 20-year rainfall event, potentially if it's absolutely saturated, could produce a 100-year flood. Conversely, you might get a 100-year rainfall in a very, very, very dry catchment, might only produce a 20-year flood. So it's not just related to rainfall. So anyway, there's some detailed discussion there in the report just about that information. So that was that got us to the point where we now had a flow rate at the top end of our model, but we then needed to apply that to the system to produce the mapping. So we used a software called HECRAS, a 2D HECRAS model. It brought in the that digital elevation LIDAR survey. It brought in the detailed survey, which showed all the details of the culverts underneath the main road. We obviously had to put a condition on the boundary conditions of the model. And also the Manning's end value is based on that site inspection and what have you. We had to apply how easily is water able to move through a catchment. So obviously water moving through a concrete car park can move a lot more smoothly and rapidly than water can get through buildings with those fences and houses and sheds in the way, and it's a lot harder for water to get through a forest than it can through a well-mown grass paddock. So there's some values there in the report that we showed about the different Manning's End values, and typically, obviously, the higher the number, the harder it is for the water to get through that part of the model. And the 1D elements there is mentioned as just those, mainly the culverts under the railway line, the pedestrian sort of footpath underneath at the bottom of the caravan park under the railway line, and also the main culverts under the main road. We also did some flood hazard mapping that you'll see in a moment. So flood hazard is really an important thing because it's how dangerous the floodwaters are. And areas in the bright red there would be loss of life, buildings getting washed away, major structural damage, significant dangerous hazard. Whereas the dark blues would be sort of fairly minor. You could walk through it. It's not a danger to life or vehicles or properties. And obviously, as you go up through those different zones, H1 up through to H6, it's a combination of velocity and depth. So if you're standing in a stagnant bathtub in your house and it's knee-deep, you're probably not going to get washed away. But if that water was washing over a road at high velocity and it's the same depth, it could possibly wash you over and cause a lot of hazard. So it's a combination of the depth of the water and the velocity. And obviously, once it gets beyond a certain point, it's hazardous irrespective of the velocity, and same with the depth. So that's sort of just a chart which you'll see at the end of the report. There's some hazard mapping which uses that categorisation. So we then put that modelling through the model and modelled basically the 20-year, the 50-year and the 100-year event. And the 20-year event broadly showed water stayed within the channel, which again implies that should that creek experience an event equivalent to about a 20-year event, which has got about a reasonably significant event, that the water would stay fully within the water course and unlikely to cause any flooding issues.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could just go back one page, and there was a statement in there that's bold. Can you just explain that again in more words to help me understand what the impact of that statement is, I suppose, for our residents?
Yeah. Sorry, I'll just read my glasses on. Yep, so what we've said there is the 20-year event, so that's in any one year there's a 5% chance of it being exceeded in any one year. That event, should we get that combination of, the flood event, if we get that event happening, a 20-year event or a 5% chance of that happening in any one year, that should stay within the watercourse and it shouldn't break out of it should get through the main road, it shouldn't go into the caravan park, it shouldn't go into people's properties. So pretty much the flow will stay within the creek and not break out of the banks of the creek. So the event that we had, obviously, in November, we believe was exceeded that because it well and truly broke its banks. And we'll see, I think, later in the report, towards the end, you'll see what the map looks like for the 20-year event. Because there's sort of appendices at the back, I could jump between back and forth, but I was potentially going to talk about that break. I might talk to the maps in a moment, but does that help understand you, Christian? Yeah. Those hydrographs there of different colours are sort of coincident on top of each other because the flow coming in is the same and there's no flow breaking out at any other locations. And then the 50-year event, we start to get breaking out from the creek, and those smaller hydrographs, the lower curves on that plot, are showing the flows in different parts of the network, such as through the caravan park. Still, predominantly, the flows are contained within the main creek, And then in the 100-year event, quite more getting more substantial flow breaking out from the creek and flowing both to the west of the creek line through the caravan park, but also on the eastern side of the main culvert crossing in the main road and heading along an easterly path and then back towards the railway line. Typically, obviously, the topography of the Middleton Creek is it is fairly flat. It's not like it's in a big steep valley by the time it gets down to Middleton Township. So once the water does get out of the creek, it's not like it's just building up higher and higher and higher. Once it does break out, it's obviously clearly passing through a secondary flow path before it's eventually able to return to the creek, or actually stays almost wholly outside of the creek when we see the flood mapping where the water that goes through the caravan park and passes through the pedestrian crossing walkway at the end of the under the railway line, that water obviously doesn't join back into the creek. But I believe that was an historical creek back in the years. So I think I was going to hold it there before I start to look at the flood mitigation options. Did anyone have any questions about the modelling? Yep.
Quick question. What was the peak amount of rainfall that you detected in that area? I mean, I know you're saying you went to the nearest thing was Trethalbyn or Victor Harbour, but the peak was on the lee side of Crow's Nest Road, up on the top of the ridge,
yep.
Which where the bulk of the rain would have fallen, come rattling down those seven gullies.
Yep.
Did you estimate what the final amount was, or did you speak to the farmers that had the gauges up there, the unofficial gauges, or not?
We've obviously got some anecdotal information through council, but we basically relied on the bureau gauges. But there are obviously we had that weather tracker radar footage, which showed clearly that there was high intensity rainfall on the specific catchment, and that's why we felt that relying just on the bureau data on its own was misleading, because we felt there was a higher intensity rain in the area. And again, unfortunately, the rainfall gauges of I got 80 millimetres or 70 millimetres. The important thing to understand is the time that occurred across as well. And like the Strathalbyn gauge, for example, gives every 30 minutes. It tells you how much is coming into the gauge every 30-minute increments. So it's obviously the intensity of the rain as well as the total depth that's important. And obviously if we feel that we can look at the weather radar tracker that we know pretty much when it started raining and when it finished, and if the farmer's gauge has got 70 millimetres on it, we obviously know that it all occurred within a certain period. When we put what we estimated to be the 100-year flow through the flood mapping, it felt like it needed to be close to the 50 or the 100-year event before we were able to replicate the extents of the flooding that occurred in that event in November. So we're sort of inferring that it was 100, could easily have been a 100-year event on that day. Yep. A rain gauge or no, there isn't. I think I mentioned Gawler, Victor Harbour, Strathalbyn. I think is the only sub daily gauge that's in the area.
Yep. Thank you. You made a reference to that historic second creek.
Yep.
And understandably, the terrain of the town has changed a lot with built infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Was consideration given to that second historic watercourse in terms of, looking at solutions or mitigation strategies?
It wasn't directly. It was a possibility that pedestrian underpass could be enlarged to sort of provide maybe a bit more of a relief valve to the railway line. But there is obviously a substantial amount of water still went through that. And I think there was some reports of it's not. a formal recognised overland flow path because it just floods across footpaths and across roads, and there's not a sort of a dedicated watercourse downstream at that point, even though I think as it gets close to the coast it more or less acts as a quite a big deep valley. But certainly through, I think, the downstream of, I'm not sure the name of the road, but directly downstream I think there's a park and a reserve area, and it would all be on the surface and uncontrolled. So it's sort of a, if we did want to put a lot more water through there, it'd probably need more than just opening up the pedestrian crossing. But we're more focused, and for it to have got to that point, it's already flooded out probably houses upstream of the main road and also flooded through the caravan park. So it's sort of almost at the bottom end of the flood affected area if we were to do works down that far downstream.
Just to confirm, so what you're saying is that where it would come from the main creek, there'd mm-hmm. be too much built infrastructure in that first section before it to sort of have, you know, that it, that the water already goes through in order that
yeah.
would prevent you from considering that.
Yes, so if the only works we did was opened up that pedestrian underpass as an example, the properties that are still flood affected upstream the main road and through the surf shop or whatever it is, and I think it was the pharmacy and other, they would also get flooded pretty much just as much as they would have, and then it would get down to the caravan park, and maybe the caravan park extensive flood mightn't have been as significant, but we've still caused all that flood effect. Properties have had no benefit from that. So yeah,
there was a lot of discussion about or comment about the tree, and you showed the picture of it, the
yep.
head of that tree or bush. I question whether that had as much impact as that big pipe underneath. There's a substantial, I would say, SA water pipe that runs underneath that bridge,
mm-hmm.
which from the top side, the bridge looks fine. When you look under it from the southeastern side,
mm-hmm.
there's this great, it's a serious pipe, probably as big as that.
Yep.
Which, did you think that factored a lot into the reduction of flow and the potential for a backup? Because just looking at it, it looks like a serious pipe and a serious blockage
mm-hmm.
to what would have been a fairly clear...
Yep. No, I do know the big pipe. So one of the mitigation options you'll talk to a moment was to just substantial upgrade to that culvert crossing. And in isolation, it wasn't a very... significant improvement in capacity, and there is a report by DIT on that culvert structure. I know you're talking about the pipe rather than the culvert structure, but typically a restriction like that, generally once it gets into the culvert, it's able to force its way through. It's often the control on the upstream side that's often the limiting factor in those sort of culverts, sort of you call it inlet control. But obviously that pipe, it's not ideal that it's where it is, but it's probably not a substantial reduction in capacity. But if it was done again, it would be nice if it was undergrounded or whatever, or bought up higher or something. But it wasn't. I don't think it's a significant issue, but it is. We did note it. Yes. Yep.
Yeah, you're talking about that culvert. If that culvert, the restrictions had been less, or if it had been a larger culvert, would that then have caused the flooding to be of greater impact on the beach side of the road? Because in a sense, it was acting like a bit of a dam, maybe?
Yes, so there was... You're talking about downstream of the railway line, is in terms of where there would have been more impacts?
Well, the culvert is at the road.
Yep.
But on the other side of the road, that's where it then made its way to the beach.
Yep.
And there was flooding of the caravan park and other areas.
Yes.
But if that culvert hadn't restricted the amount it did, would that have caused more flooding impact on the other side?
Yep. So if it had leapt more water through, the caravan park probably wouldn't have had as much flooding, because the flooding to the caravan park was due to water breaking out of the creek further upstream and coming along the... I'll show some flood maps in a moment, but yeah, so the mechanism of that would have been less. And then by nature of that, the flooding upstream would also have been better. So certainly if it had been a bigger culvert, would have been the caravan park would have had probably less flooding on. But the Yes, it theoretically caused a bit of a slight, obviously, a restriction to flow rates. So obviously there was an erosion, I think it was a footbridge that got washed away and undermined downstream of the railway line. That might have even been worse than it was. But I think the focus on the project, though, has been on the damage to and flood risk to private property upstream of the railway line and not those works downstream. But the upstream of the railway line does include, obviously, the caravan park. Any other questions? We're sort of moving on to mitigation stuff now, so I'm happy to move on to that. So we then brainstormed a whole lot of mitigation options for reducing flood risk, and some of the mitigation options we looked at combining them with each other in that that they could work synergistically together. So I'll just talk through them briefly and then look at the impacts of them. So initially I'm just going to state them now. Brought to my attention that this public-private land ownership map is slightly misleading. There is, hopefully this is my laser pointer work, yes. There are some public ownership maps that we will revise this map. So there is some council land, I think, is that right, Jonathan? Sort of through there and there, I think, that we missed from the analysis, so we'll incorporate that. But the important thing to note that I will bring to people's attention during the... where is my laser pointer gone? The main watercourse between the main road and the railway line and upstream of the railway line is not in council ownership. Which is important for some of the mitigation options that I'll talk about in a moment. But that was the purpose of that figure, which will get directed. So one option, again, I mentioned earlier, is that flow is based on the ability for something to convey flow is based on how easy that water is able to move through a creek. So one option we looked at was to reduce the Mannings value in the report by essentially replicating what would happen if vegetation was to be removed or taken out of the watercourse. The second figure there shows channel widening, so that sort of just shows a very approximation of what the channel currently looks like and what it might potentially be widened to. Flattening the batters, widening the base, obviously larger, can convey more flow. Levee banks, there was probably about five sections of levee bank that would potentially be required. They're sort of notionally shown there on that figure. Pretty much all other than one portion is in private ownership, and probably I should mention back to those other two previous options as well, the channel widening and the vegetation removal. Pretty much none of that work is within land that is owned or in control of council, and therefore it would we'll talk about it a bit later, but obviously it's not something that they're, you know, it's not like it's a council drainage reserve and for them to be managing and looking after, because it's not in council ownership. And same with levee banks. So obviously, you know, getting into there, remove vegetation is one thing, but then getting big excavators in there to dig out the channels or construct levee banks. Now, levee banks would typically be an earthen levee bank, so it would sort of just be, you know, compacted earth with clay, potentially topsoiled and landscaped. But you can see from the image there that some of those properties, particularly to the north of the main road, are quite close to the creek bank, and there's just not physical space to build a nice earthen levee at those locations. So to get a equivalent levee would need to be some sort of vertical wall, flood wall. Otherwise, you just wouldn't be able to fit it in. And again, that would all be infrastructure that's currently on land that council doesn't own or have in easements. But you can see there's fairly extensive levee banks potentially needed to keep that flood water all within the watercourse and getting it through to the culverts underneath the railway line. We did investigate flood detention. So obviously one option is, well, rather than just letting all the water go through and managing the peak flows that arrive at the top end of Middleton, that it is detained further upstream in the catchment. Quite substantial infrastructure and a large embankment would be needed. But if we can get that flow rate from sort of, 30 down to 10 odd cubic metres per second going through the township, there'd pretty much never ever be any flooding up to the at least the 100-year or 1% event. And that would, just basically hold up all the water further up in the catchment with a substantial detention basin. The dam, again, wouldn't be anywhere where there's currently publicly owned land, so it would need substantial land acquisition to construct some large structure like that. And with any dam, you build a dam. What happens if the dam fails? So you need substantial spillways, introduces a risk in its own right. If there's an earthquake or something that damages the dam, there is a township directly down to the dam, so that certainly introduces that risk that you would need to be very carefully managed if it was to ever be entertained as an option. But they're sort of showing the rough physical scope of the. Obviously, that black line is a bit schematic, but obviously have massive big embankments that would take, 30, 50 metres or something wide by the time you get up to the top of the dam and then back down the other side. So it's just schematic purposes only. And the blue extent is the area that would potentially be under floodwaters in a one of those rare sort of 100-year flood events. Early warning system was also given a consideration, so there could be gauges installed, flow gauges on the upper reaches of the river or the creek system when a certain water level gets triggered or a rainfall intensity gets beyond a certain amount. The early warning system could send out alerts to the SES and residents and property owners and all the rest of it that says there is a flood event imminent or possibly forecast by the Bureau, and to put actions in place to minimise the damage that could occur. It obviously doesn't stop the flood, but, for example, if that had been in place, there wouldn't have been sort of evacuations, for example, which obviously got a lot of press at the time out of the caravan park, because they would have had the early warning system to say, please evacuate everyone, there's a potential for a flood coming down. Or, if your house is identified as being flood prone, there is a flood risk that's imminent, please ensure that your flood action plan is being engaged. If you have, you might have sandbags that you put in appropriate places, or you remove vehicles, or move valuable items off floors, those sorts of things. But having an early warning system gives you people a bit of time to actually respond to a potential flood and reduce the amount of damage and potential risk that it can produce. And the only other talking point to that is in a more urban setting, in a very built environment, so in the middle of Adelaide, where it might be the flood event can be on your doorstep within 20 minutes because it's a very heavily urbanised area. Here it's typically going to have a couple of hours rather than minutes up your sleeve before the peak of the flood gets to Middleton, because it's got to be raining for, at least a couple of hours or so before we get substantial flooding. So that's why it's a possible option. And then it was talked about earlier, but the upgrade to the Goolwa Road culverts. So obviously there was the debris that built up against that middle column. There's the potential that could be enlarged. It could be turned into a bridge or something, so there is no middle column, or a third culvert could get put off to one side. It's obviously a DIT road. I think they've got an independent study that identifies that they feel that it isn't undersized, and so they wouldn't sort of necessarily agree. But that is an option in that, and I suppose the benefit of that option of compared to all of the other physical capital works options is it's the only option that's theoretically within council's control, in that it's not in private ownership of land at the moment. But there's obviously, you know, plenty of disruption that would occur. It's the main road through the area. It'd have to get closed. There'd be detours. There's major services in the area. It wouldn't be a straightforward exercise, but it is certainly an option we've explored. I was thinking I could now go to the flood maps rather than talk through other sections of the report, or I can talk through the sections of the report but with the flood maps as the visual. Is that a reasonable way? That way we're sort of talking to a picture rather than to words. So I'll just move forward. So just before I go to them, so that event there is the event that we talked about earlier where the existing drainage network is typically able to manage that 20-year flood. So there is a very small breakout in the caravan park, but predominantly if that event had happened in November 22, I probably wouldn't be standing here with this study, because that probably would have been a manageable event. No one would have really been affected, and it would have been a reasonable. It wouldn't have caused flood damage. Then we could step through to the 50-year event, which you can then see there's quite substantial breakout of flooding, water going through that deep yellow you see there is the water building up behind the railway line in the caravan park. It's clearly flooded and broken its banks upstream of the main road, and it's obviously moving through that secondary flow path that we mentioned earlier that was an old secondary water course, and then moving through, that's the 100-year event. So that, we think, fairly closely replicates what happened in November 22
I'm just looking at that picture, and it shows the dotted boundary, and it goes just before Walker Place. But I understand the flooding extended well to the left up William Street, probably another two or three houses. And that's not incorporated in your diagram there. Those houses were also flooded.
Yeah, we did get, as part of the survey, we did get a floor level survey of buildings that were flood affected. And one thing that I will caveat, that this map is purely showing the flows coming down the gully from the main creek, and it doesn't show any localised flooding that may have occurred due to the local, very local township network. So that may have, obviously, as to how extreme that is, we don't think it would have been a big contributor, because we feel like the main flow was the main water coming down the creek line. It could be that the event may have been more than a 100-year event as well. So that's the other side of the coin, that if the extent of flooding was more than what we're showing. Or the other thing is, hydrology is not an exact science, so we've estimated that was the flow rate that we felt to be a 100-year event based on the information that we've got available. Again, the wetness of the catchment leading up to the event, all those things, it's not an exact science. But we still got a good comparison of the mitigation options we've looked at, and we think it's a reasonable approximation of what the flood dynamic of the township has, that once it breaks out of the creek, it doesn't return back into the creek. It does flood over the main road. Does build up behind the railway line, so we feel like we've broadly captured the dynamics of what happens in a flood event. Yes, it may have, that November event may have been worse than this, even potentially worse than this, but that, I suppose, that wasn't what we're trying to necessarily replicate with that map.
So is there a map that actually shows what the extent of that flooding was on that particular day?
No, because, again, that model, for example, that you see up there, that's got the 10% culvert blockage. Now, was that tree that was against the culvert more than 10% or not? There's a whole lot of things that happen during an event that you can't always... You know, we didn't try to replicate exactly that November 22 event.
And did your remit include doing any sort of door knocking to get an actual practical picture of what was happening on that day, or...?
Yep, so we got the surveyors picked up known debris marks at all locations that they were able to pick up. So we got picked up at about three or four dwellings and also in the caravan park. So we had hard and fast sort of calibration data of the level that the water got to in that November event. So that was useful for us to also sort of say, well, we're putting in the 100-year rainfall event, and it was even potentially, you know, even on the low side of some of those reported flood levels. So that's why it's indicating, is that event even more extreme than a 100-year event, or was our hydrology slightly underestimating what the 100-year flow should be? Well, you'll go through some mitigation options now. So we ran 11 total scenarios. So obviously scenario zero was sort of what you see up on the figure there, is just sort of as is. We've run a scenario which involves creek clearing. We've got an option that runs scenario of channel widening, construction of levees, the construction of the big upstream flood dam, and the culvert upgrades. So that each sort of individual element in isolation, we looked at the effectiveness of that. We've then looked at creek clearing in combination with levees, channel widening in combination with levees, creek clearing and the culvert upgrade. Scenario 9, which was channel widening and the culvert upgrade. Scenario 10, was creek clearing, levees and the Gawler Road culvert upgrade. And then scenario 11, which wasn't modelled but was just the early warning system. So hoping these will go through. So this is just also just hazard. So that was the you know, light blue is generally low hazard, and then getting into the greens and yellows in particular is, and red obviously is significant hazard. So it's going up through the different events. So this one now, I'm just going to make sure. Yep. So this is scenario one, which is creek clearing. Shows typically, you know, up on the screen like that, it doesn't make a significant change to the flood extents. It typically reduces sort of flood depth in the order of sort of 100 to 200 mils. It slightly reduces the amount of flow that goes over the Gawler Road and potentially gets the standard of the system sort of from a 20 to 30-year standard up to about a 40-year standard. So it certainly does some improvement, but not substantial. Then we look at scenario 2, which is channel widening. So you can sort of see between that and the first one, it makes a larger improvement. Flood depths in the caravan park are sort of reduced by 200 or 300 mils. Some of the flood hazard categories have reduced, and the flood depths are in around private property upstream of Gawler Road are sort of reduced by about 60 millimetres. So that's a reasonably effective strategy. And then scenario 3 is to put in levee banks. So surprise, surprise, it keeps all the water inside the levee banks. Essentially channelises the flow, keeps it within the watercourse. They'd need to be up to, in some points, up to 1.4 metres high, so not an insubstantial levee bank. And they would need to be five different sections of levee bank, and the issues of them in very close proximity between them and private properties. They're not currently in any private in private ownership, and they might need to have potentially in some locations, you know, 1.4 metre high bank if there's not enough width to produce a nice earth embankment, the only option is to really have a vertical flood wall, which can be landscaped and made to look quite nice, but it is a physical barrier that you're not getting from A to B across that levee very easily. And obviously that would produce a 100-year standard of flood protection because the levees would be built high enough that it would keep that 100-year flood inside the creek. Then scenario four is obviously build a detention basin so that the flow arriving at the bottom end is low enough that it doesn't break out of the creek. So obviously that produces 100-year level of flood protection with no flooding anywhere, but there's a massive big dam further up the catchment. Scenario five included, it was a much larger culvert under the Goolwa Road. Again, it had some benefit. It did reduce flows in the caravan park, but then as you can see, it doesn't solve the flooding, but it still certainly has an improvement. And then, yeah, there's depths are reducing sort of in the order of 60 millimetres upstream, but again, not a substantial benefit in its own right. And then we go through some of the hybrid scenarios. So these are ones where we're combining more than one of those individual elements that we've got and stepped through for now. So scenario six is creek clearing and levees. So that the thought behind that is if we have a better conveyance of flow through the creek, the levee banks don't need to be as high. So we're sort of reducing them in the order of sort of 200 or 300 mils below the height of the if the only thing you do is levee banks option, because we're just getting more flow through the system. Obviously, you get a 100-year level of protection. The one thing I will mention about creek clearing is it's not just a once and done like the other options. Levee banks provided they're maintained, culverts provided they're maintained, etc. Sort of once and done, but creek clearing would need to be a regular sort of periodic 5-10 years or whatever it is to make sure that it's still, if people are relying on it, then it would need to be a regular thing that would need to be periodic maintenance, where these other things would be once and done. So that was scenario six. Then the other part about that one is we still feel like you'd need culverts in all five of those legs of that we mentioned in the earlier figure. Scenario seven's channel widening and levees. So some of the levee banks now we feel would no longer be required, but we'd still need three of the five. So probably slightly more effective than channel creek clearing because we've just got that much bigger capacity of the channel to take the flows. And again, that gives us obviously a 100-year level of protection, and levee banks are coming down lower again. Then we looked at scenario eight, which was clearing the creek and a culvert upgrade. Gets about a 50-year standard, we believe. Depths in the caravan park are reduced by about 200 millimetres. Floods over Goolwa Road are reduced sort of by 140 millimetres, so quite a substantial benefit, but not 100-year. And then scenario nine was widening the channel with the culvert upgrade. So again, quite an effective option, gives us close to a 60-year. There is still some localised but not significant flooding, and the flood hazard depths in the caravan park, for example, are reduced to one, which is essentially safe. Extent, getting close to the 100-year standard, but certainly probably more like a 60-year standard when they'd start to be breaking out of the flood. And then the final one that we modelled was creek clearing levees and a culvert upgrade, a bit of a hybrid. Again, it would need small levee banks, fairly modest ones, sort of only up to half a metre high, so quite more manageable. But again, would need upgrading the culverts under the main road and getting in there to remove all the not all the vegetation, but clean up some of the vegetation in the watercourse. So that was the run through of the options. I probably can either I can show some more of the mapping or talk about some of the costings or discussion. I've sort of covered some of the discussion as I've gone, but we'd probably open it up again if anyone's got any questions about any of those mitigation options or...
Would options 3 and 7, that include the levees, have an impact on the downstream infrastructure such as the footbridges?
Downstream of the railway line?
Keeping all of the water in there in a sort of 100-year event.
Yes, it would. I think it would. Correct. Yes, so there'd need to be some... I'm not sure where... I know there was a damaged footbridge, obviously, downstream. I'm not sure where that's at in terms of remedial works, but yes, you are correct. There would be a consideration that there would be an increase in flow downstream, and that may need to be... I mean, that mapping that you sort of see on the screen there would at least potentially give good intelligence to say, well, that if we were to replace things or build other things, what would that need to look like if that option ever got adopted?
Yeah, your option 4, flood detention, seems to get the best rating in terms of, you know, the weighted overall score.
Yep.
But it requires it to be built on private land.
Yep.
It also requires a front wall of about up to 8 metres high.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other options in terms of we've got 8 different streams coming down from the Victor Harbour Road? Is it a possibility that each of those has a retention dam, something a bit less substantial, which then can also be used for other uses during other parts of the year? Or have you considered that? Or what?
Not in explicit detail like that. I think you could go down that path, but generally speaking, you know, it is certainly an option. It starts to become a little bit of an asset burden, though, if there is a council's having to manage 10 assets rather than one in terms of risk of failure or cracks appearing on the dams or managing the spillways and that sort of thing. But theoretically, and I don't know how it would balance, I mean, the reason why we sort of discounted that flood detention option was we think it's in the... bit hard to guess, estimate accurately off of the concept design, but $5+ million to build that land and then a lot of land acquisition potentially on top of that. I don't know there'd be a big cost saving necessarily to decentralise it and have 10 smaller ones. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but I don't think it would still be a substantial undertaking. And I suppose if you there need to be a reasonable way downstream in the catchment, because if they're quite high up, obviously the downstream of that in its own right will be enough to produce too much flow that you'd still exceed the capacity of the system. But decentralised possibly could be an option, but I don't think it's going to make a big... My gut feel is I don't think it would make a big cost saving, and it might even be more expensive and possibly more of a maintenance issue in the long term. Yep.
When you talk about a detention dam, do you mean a dam that holds water?
No.
Right.
No.
Well, that's a good start. The idea of having all those dams up on private land that are not holding water brings in itself a series of problems, because I think there's very limited water up there anyway as far as stock water is concerned, I can see that being quite a challenge up there. The idea of a detention dam down further, it's the volume of water that came down. Any detention dam on that day would have been struggling.
Mm.
The amount of volume. All it'll do is give the Middleton residents an opportunity to get away, where they had very little time, as I understand it, that night,
mm-hmm.
like minutes. And from what one resident told me in particular. So it needs to be pretty substantial to take that volume of water quickly.
Yep.
I just see those little ones. I can't see them working particularly well because there's still a lot. That's only talking on the western part of that catchment area. Mm. You've still got the eastern side with it's virtually smooth-faced, so you still get a huge amount coming down from that side.
Mm.
And I believe you still need that one at the bottom, but that I mean, there are challenges all the way around, aren't there, whichever way you do. And the other thing, bear in mind, is that it's the watercourses have been filled up in Middleton, but there were watercourses there right in by the railway line, below the railway line, until it was a rubbish dump, and they filled all up and made a rubbish dump, and filled all up. So it's you can be thinking that, oh, it wasn't really bad. A huge amount of water has come down that gully over a period of hundreds of years and scarred the country that's been rehabilitated.
Mm.
And when they put the bridge in Middleton, they raised that from the old bridge. They built that up considerably with a result that it is, you know, you look around and the house back diagonally across from the bridge is actually stepped down into it. And the Middleton store now you drive into, but the old Middleton store was built up. You went up three steps to get into the old Middleton store.
Yep.
They were obviously prepared for it. But the new Middleton store was more or less built at ground level.
Mm.
And as a result, on the day, it was that much water was up against its wall.
Yep. Yep. You know, certainly the road is no longer at the low spot. The water doesn't, when it breaks its banks or goes over the road, it doesn't overtop at the culvert. It crosses, you know, either side.
Mm.
One thing probably I'd just conclusions and next steps. So we obviously put some qualitative ratings against the various options, and again they're fairly qualitative, so they're not sort of hold your hat on it and just because it gets a high score means you must that must be better. But it was an attempt to sort of give some sort of rating to the various things against the flood benefit that it provides, the affordability, how easy it can be implemented, and also how easily it would be to construct. So we gave some ratings and some weightings, with obviously flood benefit being the main weighting, which obviously, you know, flood detention scores the highest there. But then affordability, it gets an absolute zero because it's by far probably the most expensive option. So we try to give a bit of a rating on the various things. And then at the report, we've sort of mentioned it would appear that scenarios 3 and 7, which is creating flood levies with or without widening the creek bank, would be potentially an option to consider for further investigation, and also potentially the option of widening the creek and upgrading the Gawler culverts. And also consideration of an early warning system. I do mention it is mentioned though at the end of the report that often works are done on the basis of you know, council's only got a finite investment budget, and the potentially can be that is a do-nothing option still an option. We've sort of highlighted that we feel that event was closer to even exceeding a 100-year event, but also maybe that there are flood damages in less than a 100-year event. But if it was, say, a 500 or a 1,000 or a 5,000-year event, it would be, well, council wouldn't really have a duty, could never really realistically have done anything to have stopped flooding occurring on that day. And that would be an unrealistically high level to have council to meet, and it's not. If someone builds a new house, they'd say you can build it in a 150-year, outside of the 100-year floodplain, and therefore if a 200-year flood comes along, you'll get flood damage. But that's the level that we accept that there's that interface. Otherwise, no one'd be able to build anywhere. So, do nothing option is still is discussed in the report as an option, because council obviously needs to make sure that, you know, the value that they're going to get from it is, you know, they've obviously got competing interests across the whole council area, and this is one part of their council. So I just sort of mentioned that, you know, one possible option is to do a full detailed analysis of the damages that were occurred, and then the amount of works and capital works to get that expenditure to get the capital the flooding down to zero, and then look at a benefit cost viability assessment of how what the because, you know, if you had to spend $10 million to protect one house, it's probably not worth it. But if you can spend $100,000 to protect 20 houses, obviously it's worth it. But there's a point where you've just got to balance the economics of competing interests. And if there was unlimited money, that it could fix everything, but it's obviously got to compete against other things on their agenda. And hopefully this report give council informed decision to work out what the next steps are. I think I also mentioned earlier on that I think as a minimum council should at least make the information broadly available, of public information of the flood maps, so that information is knowledge, people know and can react to flooding, and I think it's important that eventually it's made, you know, public available information that people can hopefully, if it did occur in 500, you know, 100 years' time, 10 years' time, whatever, at least that information's out there that people can respond to it in a more effective manner than they might have in the past with that knowledge. So, and that doesn't cost a lot to do that.
Okay, is there any final questions? I think my next step is, I think this is a very complex subject which I'd like to have another workshop with council members to discuss before we present a report back. We'll probably present a report back in March, but before that we'll have another workshop to discuss that in more detail. We have made this publicly available already, so it is out there for people to see. I'm happy to distribute it even wider if we can. Is there any final questions for Tim? Luke?
I just had one more question. In reading through, I didn't see anything, and forgive me if I've missed it, just in reference to our changing climate. I know you can only work on the models, the current models that you've got,
yep.
But could you give us a comment on you know, how to interpret this report with an uncertain climate ahead of us?
Yeah, sure. Yep. So obviously the ability for the air to hold moisture is related to how warm the air is. So the warmer air gets, the more moisture it can basically hold, and therefore when it rains it potentially can release that at a higher rate. So Department of Transport, for example, they might say if we wanted to design something for 2050 or 2090, we would look at potentially multiplying rainfall by about 15% odd. So if we say got a 100-year event in November, if it was a 100-year event and there was 80 mils of rain, in 2090 we think that's probably going to be closer to 90 or 100 millimetres. So yes, flooding, that event theoretically would potentially get worse in the future in those high-intensity, short-duration rainfall events. So yes, there was a very good question. So yes, there could be some consideration needed as part of the detail. If any of those options develop further, we might say, well, hang on, that levy bank needs to be a metre. But what you can do is you can say, well, can we make it higher if we needed to in the future? Because it's a prediction of climate change. Maybe it goes a different way and maybe we don't get higher rainfall intensities. But if we've got the provision to be able to change it in the future, then that's great. But if we build something that we can't adapt in the future, then we don't want to be in that position. So the options, I think, are basically, I'd have to double check. I think it's based on your current climate, but yes, you're absolutely right. We would want to consider going forward that we give careful consideration to climate change.
Okay, thank you very much, Tim. Gallery, I have a copy of this report if anyone wants to take a copy with them. Bron, I saw your hand first. I'll give it to you. I just don't want to waste the paper. Does anyone else want to hand reports or?
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's it's an interesting one. All right, I'll ask, I think, Kylie to come forward and introduce our next speakers. Kylie?
Stop and start.